We wanna smash, crash, pass, mass, blast the system. We wanna get it hype, get it live, get with the mission. We run the crowd loud, this pumping rhythm is hitting. We wanna make it clear, we ain't scared. This is the vision we want, we want.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips. Today's program, we're going to blow the roof off the 21st century. We speak with author and communication scholar Dr. Robert McChesney for the hour. We'll talk political economy, encroaching fascism, the importance of independent media, and how to achieve a post-capitalist democratic society. Please stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips. Today's program, blowing the roof off the 21st century, media, politics, and the struggle for post-capitalist democracy. We're joined by Professor Robert McChesney. Robert McChesney is the Gutzel Endowed Professor in the Department of Communication at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. He's the author of several books on media, including the award-winning Rich Media, Poor Democracy and Communication Revolution, and co-editor with Victor Packard of Will the Last Reporter Please Turn Out the Lights, all available on the New Press. His most recent book with Monthly Review is Blowing the Roof Off the 21st Century. Robert McChesney, thank you so much for joining us on the Project Censored Show today.
It's a pleasure, Mickey.
Please tell us, what's the title of the book implying here, and what are people getting into in your new book, Blowing the Roof Off of the 21st Century?
Well, I didn't want to have my 87th book with the title of Media, Politics, and Power or something like some combination of words that pretty much get empty the ninth time you've used the same combination of words. So that was one motivation. But really, the argument I'm making in the book, and certainly in the core chapters, the beginning and the end, is that we're in a very dynamic period right now. I mean, all periods of history, I guess, are dynamic. But we can see around us right now there are tremendous pressure points. And something's got to give. The nature of our society is under extraordinary social, economic, and environmental stress. And it's going to be very difficult for anything remotely close to democracy to survive. And it's going to be a very difficult period that's going to require radical social change. And it's going to come. The only question is, what type of social change will it be, for the better or for the worse? And I think it's in all our interest that it be social change that leads to a radical reconstruction of society to make it more equitable, more free, more democratic, and more humane and environmentally sustainable.
Robert McChesney, it's Peter Phillips. I wanted to ask you, you write about the Nader presidential campaign in 2000. You write about popular uprisings in 2011 and the willingness of, as you say, young people to really question the nature of capitalism and where people think we need to go. Is this realistic in this century?
Oh, absolutely, it's realistic. For one thing, and something I put in the introduction to the book, I think one of the issues I deal with in the book, and I deal with in all my writing now and all my talks, and let's get it right out front, is we've got to get away, I think, all of us from something I think must be part of human nature, is that we look at the situation we're in right now, the world we're in, and we look at yesterday and the day before, and we assume that tomorrow and the day after are going to be just what we have today and yesterday. And, of course, history doesn't work that way. Nothing would have ever changed if that was how the world operated. In fact, it's quite the opposite. We know we're going to have radical change. It's just very hard for us to understand what it's going to be, but it hasn't taken place yet. And we never can anticipate it in advance. And in the beginning of the book, Peter, I give the story of a professor I had in graduate school at the University of Washington, who was a white South African, but he came to the United States in the 1960s. He was opposed to apartheid. All his family still remained in Cape Town. And he worked at the ANC. He studied the anti-apartheid movement. And when I left Seattle to go to Madison for my first teaching job in 1988, I went into his office to say goodbye. And he was very morose. He was sad. And I said, "What's wrong, Tony?" And he said, "Well, he's been talking to all his comrades, all his friends in South Africa in the movement, and they'd never been so depressed. I said, it'd be impossible to have peaceful transition to power in South Africa. The Afrikaans government refused to negotiate. He said there would be so much bloodshed to get justice for black Africans in South Africa, it would make the country uninhabitable for anyone for a century." And I later learned that that opinion was widespread in the anti-apartheid movement, the ANC. It was a very gloomy period. This was May of 1988. Well, 2 years later, after the most authoritative person I knew in South Africa made this pronouncement to me, 2 years after that, Nelson Mandela was released from Robben Island Prison. 4 years after that, he was elected president of South Africa. And in that intervening 6 years, there was less violence than you'd see in a New Jersey bar fight on a Saturday night. So the point of this, the moral of the story, and the reason why this is important for people to understand is that the smartest people in the world, the most engaged people in the world working on the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa, the moment before the revolution was going to succeed, were completely wrong. They had no idea it was coming. They didn't anticipate it. They had the gloomiest possible outlook. And that's something I keep with me. And I remember stuff Howard Zinn, who I know you both are very familiar with and, like myself, learned a great deal from. But Howard Zinn used to say, he said, look, no one saw the civil rights movement coming before it came. And no one was walking around in 1952 saying, hey, 10 years from now, someone's going to have a dream. That didn't happen. No one saw it coming. No one saw any social movement coming before it came, or else it would have come back when they saw it in the first place. And we have to keep that in mind. We can't predict the future. We can't anticipate the future.
Bob, you talk about very optimistically the inevitability of a post-capitalist democracy. And, you know, of course, Howard Zinn, you lead off with his quote, you can't be neutral on a moving train. The train's moving. We don't always know where we are. And that's certainly part of what the capitalist elite want us to believe. The Occupy movement scared them. The police state infiltrated almost every organization in the country during the Occupy movement. And it did leave us with the mantra of the 99.1% in everybody's mind. So it's like we're ready for real democracy from the grassroots up. And what would be some of the signs that you would see leading us in that direction?
Well, I think you just mentioned one, Occupy. Occupy now is sort of looked at, if not nostalgically, certainly whimsically, as something that was a one-off, sort of a weird fluke no one can really quite explain. I think rather the way you've framed it, Peter, is the right way. I think if you look at Occupy, what it was is that when sort of a crack in the facade is bust open, you have a torrent, a flood of human anger and passion that rises up and goes through that crack, as you saw in Occupy. And I think the polling data shows this, too. I mean, the polling data, and I'm very skeptical about these, the polls, because what you ask oftentimes determines what you find and how you ask it. But the BBC and Pew and some other institutions have been doing annual polls of young people and people's attitudes towards politics and economics now for years and years and decades. And they saw a sharp shift over the last 10 or 15 years that really escalated by the end of the last decade, in which young people in particular were far more critical of capitalism. The term capitalism no longer evokes sort of a positive, squishy image of freedom and happiness and consumer shopping frenzy. Instead, capitalism was regarded in a very dubious and quite critical and increasingly negative manner by all Americans, but especially Americans under the age of 30. And in fact, the BBC data shows that in polling that capitalism is no more popular than socialism as a term for people under 30 in poll after poll. Now, what's striking about this is no one knows anything about socialism in the United States. It's not taught anywhere. The only time you hear about it is really when Fox News or some politician criticizes it for being horrible. And so people, young people are picking socialism not because they know much about it, but they just know it isn't capitalism. So it's got to be better, because the real world of capitalism, not the fairy tale that politicians and pundits and mainstream economists talk about, but rather the real world of corporate monopolies, price gouging, rip-offs, lousy jobs, no unions, no protection, absolutely corrupt governance where it's controlled and dominated by the wealthy few. That real world young people are living through, and they know that is no future for them. So they just opt for whatever plan B is in that situation. To me, that's very revealing about the troubles in our times. And it's also a sign that, you know, what this system is on much more fragile ground than I think people realize. Its continued success is far more up in the air than it has been in my lifetime, and that includes the 1960s or 70s.
We're speaking with Professor Robert McChesney, author of numerous books on media, political economy. His newest book, a collection of many writings on vast topics, is titled Blowing the Roof Off the 21st Century, Media, politics and the struggle for post-capitalist democracy. So it's certainly an ambitious book, and also Bob, a lot of optimism throughout. And the first chapter, America, I Do Mind Dying, that kind of starts to set the stage for what you get into, particularly, you know, your critique of capitalism.
I start the book by saying, look, here are the long-range trends, long-run trends that are taking place in America and to varying degrees worldwide, but especially in the United States. We're seeing, you know, vast increases in economic inequality and poverty. And I know, I'm sure in this program, you probably talked about Thomas Piketty's book, The French Economist, who pretty much showed empirically that growing inequality is built into capitalism, and that capitalism, when it goes through a slow growth phase like we're in right now, increasingly resembles feudalism. The people at the top of it with most money are people who basically inherited their wealth and are protecting their privileges. So we're living that. We're living what Piketty described. But he says it's built right into capitalism. It's not just a fluke. Secondly, all of our leading political scientists, I shouldn't say all of them, I should say several of them, from Berkeley, from Stanford, from Michigan, from Princeton, from University of Virginia, have been doing studies of how power operates in the United States in the last 10 or 20 years, who influences the government, the federal government and state governments, when it makes decisions on fundamental policies that affect the American people, on economics, on trade, on foreign policy. And what all the studies have found, without exception, the three great studies that have been published in the last 3 years, is that virtually all the important decisions that are made in the United States are made to represent the interests of what Peter called the 1% of those at the very top, and that the interests, values, concerns of the great bulk of the population have absolutely no effect whatsoever on government. In effect, we have a plutocracy, or what John Nichols and I have called a dollarocracy, where those with money basically own the board, and those without any money don't have any role whatsoever. We're not a democracy in any functional sense. And then the third great trend that's going on is the environmental trend, the crisis we see with the climate, and there are even other issues beyond climate, but climate sort of the game changer, because if we don't have an atmosphere, we're not going to be around too long. You know, you put these three things together, they're not getting better, they're only getting worse, they're not going away, and they define very much the immediate world all of us live in, and all our children will live in, and our students and our friends and their children. You know, it's really a cauldron. It's not something that can last forever. Something's got to give. Something it is giving. It's in the process of giving. So I argue that that's the framework to understand it. And people say, well, how can you be an optimist? You just described a situation where things are getting worse and the people in power have control over the government. My optimism comes from a number of different sources, but one of them is that because so much of my research is studying large corporations, studying how they handle politics, studying what they're doing, and what I learned early on and see repeated over and over is how the corporations that set up all the lobbying in Washington, that set up all these groups like ALEC and all these front groups, they're in fear of democracy. They're petrified at the idea of having a high voter turnout in non-gerrymandered elections in the United States where there were real choices in the ballot. And for the last 40 years, capitalist interests, corporate interests have been working incessantly to make this as undemocratic a country as possible. So people with as much money as they want, they can spend it all to influence elections. They want to repress the vote in places where they can't win an election, even with a low voter turnout. They want to make it even lower, make it harder for people who are considered not sufficiently happy with capitalism to vote. We see all sorts of mechanisms to make it very hard to vote, to make it very hard for people to participate. We're seeing our media system, which is never any great shakes to begin with, turn towards ever more sewage in terms of journalism. You put all that together and you see how much fear there is at the top. And you say, well, they're scared of something. Well, what are they scared of? They're scared of the fact they know that they don't have the numbers on their side. They can't win a fair fight. And to me, that's very empowering.
Bob, you write here, democracies under capitalism, you don't say that, but democracy has been reduced to powerless people rooting for their favorite billionaire or corporate lobby to advance their values and interests, hoping that such a billionaire exists and they get lucky. Doesn't that sound like an oligarchy? I mean, you certainly lay that out. And if we look at this, not just in terms of the U.S., I mean, part of the fights in the Ukraine are between various capitalist billionaires. Billionaires are ruling China. Billionaires are greatly in power in Russia. This is transnational. And so are we really talking about a global transformation?
Unquestionably. And most of these essays were U.S.-based. So the focus of the book for that reason I made U.S.-centric. But the arguments are, you know, you have to qualify everything as you go to different countries that have different specific conditions. But the basic themes and arguments are true worldwide, certainly about the environment, certainly about capitalism and inequality, and certainly about corruption of government. These are worldwide phenomena.
We're speaking with Professor Robert McChesney. His newest book is Blowing the Roof Off the 21st Century. We'll be right back after this musical break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We're speaking with Professor Robert McChesney. His most recent book is Blowing the Roof Off the 21st Century. Bob McChesney, in part one of your book, Putting the Politics Back in Political Economy, I actually teach a course on political economy, but it's interesting that a number of years ago that the title of the course changed from Political Economy of Democracy to Money, Power, and Politics. I think it was maybe a sexier title to get people to come in without their eyes glazing over. But what's interesting is the first night of class, I explained to them just generically what do we mean by political economy of democracy, and the whole course goes through and outlines, and again, many of the things that you have here in this section are things that certainly come up. And even though it's certainly a semester's worth of outlining some of the key challenges we face in each segment, it's also quite optimistic. And as you yourself said, it actually isn't difficult to be optimistic about this given history and given the history of social change and given the fact that we do have ebb and flow. So despite the fact that we have an oligarchic political series of institutions in the United States, there have been serious periods of change. And even if reform maybe is tepid for people that want radical change, we certainly have had it. I wanted to go into a little bit, open this can of worms here. Peter was just mentioning, too, the fact that we have a political system dominated by not just millionaires, but billionaires, right? And you alluded to Alec, and that, of course, is connected to Koch brothers and this kind of thing. We're now facing, and of course, the corporate news media's horse race coverage. We're always looking for the next election. It's Clinton 2.0, Bush 3.0, 2016. It's already out of the gate that this is the foregone conclusion of who Americans might get to select. You know, this last election, we saw about a 37% turnout nationally. That seems like people are quite cynical about the choices. But you start talking about the Nader campaign of 2000. And again, I know that's a can of worms for some, certainly on the left in the U.S. or among progressives, I might say. So what is your long view from the Nader campaign, you say, the future of U.S. left electoral politics? Certainly Hillary Clinton doesn't represent left electoral politics.
Hillary Clinton, I think, is the poster child of sort of corporate Democratic politics. There are certain issues. I think she is radically superior to whatever the Republicans have put up. But when it comes to militarism and foreign policy, or when it comes to corporate control of the economy and financialization and Wall Street and big money and politics, she's right there. She is right in the middle of it. That's her game. That's her comfort zone. She has been a champion of commercial corporate interests at home and a champion of U.S. militarism abroad throughout her career. That's who she is. So she's hardly in advance. And only when compared to someone who is those things and then also homophobic and misogynistic or whatever else the Republicans will drag up, does she compare favorably. But for someone to view her in the same context, even of what the Democratic Party just put up in the past of Franklin Roosevelt or George McGovern as a candidate. She's not remotely close to them in terms of what she stands for, or remotely close to prospective challengers she might face, like Bernie Sanders, who's giving very serious consideration to running, who I think would offer a genuine alternative to the mainstream consensus of American elite politics.
Which may, of course, be also a sort of allusion back to the Nader campaign of 2000. I mean, Hillary Clinton was on the board at Walmart. Financially, these people are all neoliberals, essentially. They're all viciously capitalistic, pro quote-unquote free market, even though that's highly inaccurate in terms of how it operates. But I want to get back to this narrative, the Nader narrative. I mean, even in progressive circles, we certainly see Democrats doing this, blaming Nader for the loss of the 2000 election, even though all the facts on the ground indicate that that, in fact, was not at all the case.
He was unfairly blamed. I mean, clearly, if the Gore-Lieberman campaign had really fought, they would have won Florida. They didn't really fight as hard as they should have. And they had the vote. They had the election stolen from them. I think the evidence is in on that. That they could have pressed it and probably won that.
Well, they actually did win the recounts in Florida. That's my point. The narrative is even inaccurate. The historical narrative that's parroted by the corporate media and the Democratic establishment. I mean, that's the ready-made frame to criticize a Bernie Sanders, an Elizabeth Warren.
Yeah, but I mean, there's a difference here, which is that if Bernie Sanders were to run, he'd probably run in the Democratic primaries, and likewise Warren. Right. The critique of Nader was, look, if you'd run in the primaries, you know, you wouldn't have been a bad guy. You could have raised your issues. And then if you lost, you wouldn't have been handing the election to a Republican. And I don't think that's an illegitimate criticism. As I was worked for Nader very closely, and I've had lots of debates about whether you should run as third parties during 2000. The friends of mine, like Jimmy Weinstein, the editor of In These Times, you know, this was a contentious issue for a lot of people on the left. I understood it. And whether it was fair or not to criticize Nader for costing Gore the election, the fact of the matter was, if Nader had been a lot more successful, like I hope he would, he might have cost him the election. That's what happens when you run as a third party candidate. I get that. But I think the criticism I would make of Nader today, of that campaign, is that the big claim to me with Nader in that campaign, what was exciting about it was that Ralph was really, in his speeches, in his talks, and he was ran a brilliant campaign by the end. He was talking about this campaign is about building something for the future, building a foundation, really building something that can last, and not just being an ego trip for himself or one person. And, you know, nothing came out of it. It didn't. So it really was a bit of false advertising. Because I wasn't especially interested in just doing a protest campaign for the heck of it. That's not, you know, I might vote for a protest candidate, but I'm not going to waste my energy and my labor on it. And we didn't get something lasting out of it. And so I think it's not purely Ralph's fault. I don't blame him for that entirely. I think he takes some of the responsibility. And I don't think the historical times of 9/11 coming along were really of great assistance either towards helping a third party. But the Nader campaign, in retrospect, I think showed how much pent-up enthusiasm there was, especially among young people, for an alternative. But it also demonstrated the real difficulty of doing third parties in the United States, especially at the state or national level. The game is really, really rigged to make it hard for that to work, except in times of extraordinary crisis like, you know, the American Civil War.
Robert McChesney, what about this Nader right-left alliance, what he's been doing recently? In other words, looking at the disaffected politically and finding common ground among perhaps people on the farther left and libertarian right.
Well, I think on certain issues, I think it's great. I'm all for it. I think, you know, there's a libertarian right that is very much opposed to government spying, government surveillance, corporate surveillance as well, and is also very hostile to this brain-dead, moronic, suicidal militarism that controls and dominates our society. And there, I think it's absolutely necessary that there be alliances across left and right. I don't know how many other issues there are. I hear, you know, you hear oftentimes, and I know rank-and-file conservatives hate the sort of corruption of governance just as much as anyone else. They don't like the idea that their politicians are bought off by commercial interests or banks or huge lobbies. But, you know, I don't know how effectively they're willing to fight on it. I think they will fight on surveillance. They will fight on some issues, militarism. And where they will fight with us, we definitely, progressives, need to stand together. And I've seen that with Free Press when I worked with that media reform group. You know, occasionally we had some very good alliances with conservative grassroots types where we shared initiatives and we didn't get any problems with, like, we had to sign off on each other's other issues. We kept our very solid alliance on key issues. So I think it's definitely something to work on. I think it'd be absurd not to. You know, I think if you do go into politics saying, here's a checklist of 120 issues that I have a position on, and before I work with you, you've got to agree with me on 85 of these, even though we're only going to work on one of them. You know, you're not going to get anywhere.
Bob, I'm going to switch gears here a little bit. I want to ask you about the crisis of capitalism, stagnation, surplus capital. We did research in our 2014 book on the transnational corporate class, the financial core. We found out that 160-some people control $7 trillion worth of wealth and money management firms, constantly looking for ways to invest bring capital increase, looking for, you know, a 7% return. That's almost become impossible, and there's literally surplus capital. Talk about stagnation and what that means to the inevitability of capitalism's difficulties.
I'd be glad to. It's a great question. Thanks for asking it, Peter. Yeah, this is a lot of work I've done over the years with my dear friend John Bellamy Foster, a professor at the University of Oregon and the editor of Monthly Review magazine. And we had a book that came out in 2012 called The Endless Crisis. I think you're probably alluding to it there. And, you know, our argument, and this grows out of a left tradition associated most frequently with Paul Sweezy and Paul Moran and Harry Magdoff, that American capitalism, monopoly capitalism, has a tendency to stagnation. That mainstream economists always say that the American market economy, left on its own to its own devices, will gravitate towards full employment with rising incomes and sort of all happy people on decks and everything working well. My argument, or our argument simply, is that monopoly capitalism in the United States, the real world capitalism of giant corporations that have semi-monopolistic power in a high number of markets, tends towards stagnation. It tends towards low growth, increasing poverty, increasing inequality, and that it is a fundamentally troubled and irrational society. And that if you start from that premise going back almost a century, then you look at the exceptions to be explained as the periods of high growth, of shrinking inequality, of growing incomes. And I think when I grew up, and I think, Peter, you and I are roughly in the same era, Mickey, you follow us by a tad, you know, I grew up in the 50s and 60s and into the 70s, and I grew up in a world in which incomes were rising in capitalism. The system was relatively strong, probably the strongest period, you know, in the 20th century. And during that period, the idea that the fundamental sort of course of modern capitalism was sort of stagnation seemed very abstract. Now it seems a lot less abstract. And I won't go into the details of the economics, but it certainly makes it clear with all the troubles we're having. A core part of our argument is that with the problems built into modern capitalism, growth becomes such a factor, finding places to invest profitably, that you see the growth of the debt structure. Debt grows in the 80s and 90s and zeros as a way to stimulate the economy and to keep it going. That without that debt, we'd have been in far worse shape in terms of stagnation and depression-type economics. And I argue, and I believe, that that's a pretty good way to understand where we're going here on out. And at this point, I think it's sort of striking that some of our leading economists from across the political spectrum who have been much more optimistic about capitalism until quite recently, people like Lawrence Summers, who worked for, you know, the former president of Harvard and head of the Economic Advisors and Secretary of the Treasury, on one hand, or Joseph Stiglitz or James Galbraith, on the other hand, who are more liberal Keynesian economists. And this is pretty much a consensus that we are now in a period of what Galbraith calls the new normal, that we're in a period of really the second depression, and it's not going to change. There's no reason on the horizon. This is the new normal, as Galbraith put it. And that really is sort of the backdrop of the book, of Blowing the Roof Off the 21st Century, is that, you know, we're in an era in which, for young people today, the labor market is as bad as it's been probably in a century, since the 1930s. And for college graduates, it's worse now than it was in the 1930s by a wide margin. And we're in an era in which there's not much of a future, when there's tremendous downward pressure on wages and on the quality of work because of the unemployment and the power of business and capital, in which pensions and the sort of unemployment insurance, all the sort of the hard-fought benefits that people have earned in the last century are being taken away, reduced, lessened by powerful political forces that are unsympathetic to the great bulk of the population. This is the theater in which we live. This is the playing field we play on. And this playing field, which is very different from the one of 1965 or even 1995, you know, crisis is the operative word to understand where we're in and where we're going.
We're speaking with Professor Robert McChesney, author of numerous books, including his newest, Blowing the Roof Off the 21st Century. We are talking about political economy, encroaching fascism, the importance of independent media, and how to achieve a post-capitalist democratic society. And Bob McChesney, we see a long trajectory through the 20th century of increased accumulated capital and concentration of capital. And you write in the book, going back to 1938, Franklin Roosevelt was sending a message to Congress that said, "The first truth is that the liberty of a democracy is not safe if the people tolerate the growth of private power to a point where it becomes stronger than their democratic state itself. That, in its essence, is fascism. Ownership of government by an individual, by a group, or by any other controlling private power." Sure. Now, granted, you were connecting this to Milton Friedman, Henry Simons, University of Chicago. You're connecting it to these ideas. And we've certainly seen that kind of going off the rails as we ended the 20th century and now in the 21st century with the Koch brothers. Even elite studies at Princeton and Northwestern call the U.S. an oligarchy. But let's be more frank and let's use the F word here. The U.S. seems to have certainly a fascist strain, a fascist culture, and we've seen the encroaching police state. Can you comment a little bit on that and how you've discussed some of it through the book?
There's so much there. It's such a great question, and I couldn't agree more. And I'm glad you picked that FDR quote out, which is not as widely known as it should be. It was in a message to Congress that didn't get a lot of publicity. And I discuss it there because Milton Friedman, in his classic defense of capitalism and why it was the best possible system, he said it was the only system that was suitable for democracy because under capitalism, the economic power was controlled in the competitive market and political power was controlled by a completely different set of people who were elected. And so you had a diffusion of power, unlike feudalism or Soviet communism, where the people who owned the country also were the people who ran the government. And they said that was antithetical to being in a free society. And Milton Friedman's defense of capitalism, I point out, is completely broken down. We're much more in FDR's world. We don't have competitive markets in the classical economic sense. We have huge monopolies, and those monopolies completely dominate governance of the country. They always get their way unless they have a battle with each other. Then that's the only fights we really get anymore. So we are in the FDR moment. We have a political economy that comports far more to fascism than it does to classical democracy by the Milton Friedman standards and the Franklin Delano Roosevelt standards. That's how they would look at this. And it's also the question of militarism enters in very strongly because that's a crucial part of fascism. And here, I think one of my favorite quotes from all time, and I can't recall if it's in this book, I use it about everything I write for the last 15 years, comes from President James Madison. After he left office, and Madison, of course, wrote the Constitution. And one of the things that's striking about the Constitution is that the people who wrote the Constitution of the United States were a group, by and large, that was not completely sympathetic to democracy, but they also were completely sympathetic to tyranny. They were opposed to kings and tyrants. They wanted to have some sort of republican rule and the rule of law. And Madison and Jefferson both detested the idea of militarism. That's why our Constitution has in it all sorts of provisions to make it very difficult to go to war, very difficult to have a standing army. You know, as George Mason put it, he wanted to impede war making. That was the goal of the framers of the Constitution, the fundamental thing. They understood that militarism was antithetical to the rule of law and democracy. And Madison, in this wonderful quote he had, said that if a country is permanently at war, if it's constantly militarized, that it will invariably lead to inequality, corruption, secrecy, what he called emoluments of the people, basically meaning propaganda to whip people into hysterical support of whatever leaders want to do. And it will be antithetical to the government being democratic. And his concluding line in this passage, and I'm paraphrasing it, is that no country can remain permanently at war and remain free. And I think he's basically describing what the United States has become in the last 50 years. Until 1945, the United States was a big, powerful country that had imperial interests. It had a large military. But it also, after major wars, the military would stand down. It would stand down, and we would get much smaller. That happened after the Civil War, after World War I. But after World War II, owing significantly to economic issues that Peter raised earlier, which is the need to basically have huge government pump priming to keep the economy going, coming out of the Second World War, it was decided by people in power to keep the military at full wartime spending levels, and we've been at them ever since then, even when we had no enemies on the horizon in the 1990s, and we had to cook up a bunch of guys up in Afghanistan to justify a $1 trillion budget since then. And, you know, it has led to basically what Madison feared and what Roosevelt feared, which is that we have $1 trillion of our federal budget now spent on militarism, national security, and the like. And money is almost completely unaccountable to Congress. They really have nothing to say about it. It's sort of off limits. And what those forces do are largely off limits to any sort of popular congressional control, with very few exceptions. We're almost in a situation not unlike 7 days in May or the French Fourth Republic, where it's unclear if you could dismantle this militarism politically and pull it off without a coup. I mean, I'm just throwing that out there. It's so off the table for anyone to even talk about that it's not even a hypothetical issue at this point. But it's built in, it's hardwired into our political economy. And militarism is antithetical to democracy for the reasons Madison said. It promotes sort of a going along with leaders, a hysteria, a propaganda state. Everything about it is something that is not good for democracy. It's been true going back to the ancient Athenians and the Romans. Both of the republican systems in Athens and in Rome crumbled largely due to the imperial pressures of being an empire and a militarized state. The two weren't compatible. And we're in that period right now. And I think that's one of the defining features of American life. Now, I've had the flip side of that, which is the domestic side, which is with the militarization of our police forces that we've seen in the last 30 years, has been one of the great stories. And we also have seen the growth of the prison industrial complex, such that America has now behind bars or in its prison system a higher percentage of its population, if I'm not mistaken, than any other nation in the history of the human race, including, you know, Stalin, Soviet Union, and South Africa under apartheid. Hitler's Germany. It's a rather extraordinary accomplishment. And they're two sides of the same coin. They're related to each other. It's the idea of the state being a penal, policing, militarized force, and being a force that serves those at the top, not those at the bottom.
Bob, you write how the Trilateral Commission wrote in 1970s about the crisis of democracy, which really what they meant was that poor people, young people, women, people of color were getting too involved in the political process. They needed to kind of deal with that in some way. And you're mentioning here massive increase in incarceration. Your book talks about the doubling of civilian government spending for public safety, police, so that there's a repressive side of that. Literally the new Jim Crow that Michelle Alexander writes about. But leading from that, and you're saying that moving to democracy, we absolutely need a vibrant, independent media. Could we talk a little bit about that?
Well, sure. This isn't an original idea. It's pretty much a cornerstone of democratic theory that if self-government's going to work, if people are going to have the power to govern their own lives in a political, social environment, political system, they have to know what they're doing. They have to have information that's reliable, that's credible, so they know how what's going on and what the alternatives are. Without that, you can have the right to vote, or you can have the ability to vote. And if you have no idea what's going on or what will happen depending on the outcome of the election, it'll be a pretty meaningless right. So having the information is foundational to a free society being functional. And the news media tend to play that role in most modern advanced societies, any modern society, and they have for a couple of centuries. And that's always been the basis of a lot of my work. It's certainly been the basis for Project Censored and the great work that's been done there. And it's the crisis we face, that we are in a situation now in which the caliber of what we get for news and information is woeful compared to what we need if we're going to understand the world to change it. It's why so many of us, including all three of us, have worked so hard to engage, to criticize the mainstream news media and provide an alternative and have a vision of an alternative system that would be far more suitable to a self-governing society.
Well, Bob, would you agree that this increased repression, police state, is also manifested via the cultural apparatus that Mills talks about in terms of the control of the media and top-down propaganda, deliberate propaganda, to mislead and misinform?
Well, of course. I mean, again, our news media, our commercial news media, going back to the beginning of the sort of latest round of Law and Order in the 60s and 70s and into the 80s, you know, our commercial news media are really not interested in poor people of color, especially, unless they get in the way of rich people. You know, you don't see feature stories on, gee, how's life going for some, you know, single mom who's working two jobs with three kids, you know, in their lifestyle section of the newspaper or the specials on CNN. The worldview of the people who do news media in the United States is their audience is middle and upper class. And with people disposable income, the people their advertisers want to reach, and issues they pick to cover outside of elite political issues, where elites decide what to be covered, are going to be sort of how things influence that crowd of the people they see as their readers and their target audience. And as a result, poor people basically don't even show up. They don't factor. And they're just seen as someone to be manipulated, moved around, and hopefully they won't get in the way of everyone else, especially poor people of color, especially black men. And so you have a situation in the United States where we've seen over the last three decades this spectacular increase since the mid-70s in the number of men, especially black men, behind bars in prison, largely for drug crimes. And we have all the evidence that shows that black men do not commit these crimes any more than white men or other people do, but they're arrested at a much greater rate and convicted at a much greater rate. This is all known. Yet it's barely a news story in the United States. It's hardly covered. When Michelle Alexander's new Jim Crow book came out, you would have thought that, you know, she had discovered something like Einstein in 1905 coming forward with the theory of relativity. But it was all out there. I mean, I read about it. The chapter I wrote in this book was written a couple of years before Michelle Alexander's book. This probably has a lot of that data. But it's simply off limits because it was of no interest to our mainstream media. Poor people, people of color, are really no interest unless they get in the way of white people. And so they get in the news when you have unarmed black people being shot down by cops in Ferguson or being killed in Staten Island or shot in Cleveland, Ohio, or wherever. They become news when hell is raised, so they create demonstrations and interfere with white people's lives. Then they become a news story. But in and of themselves, if there weren't those demonstrations, if there was that outrage, it would not be a news story, and it normally never is a news story.
We're speaking with Professor Robert McChesney. His newest book is Blowing the Roof Off the 21st Century. We'll be right back after this musical break. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We're speaking with Professor Robert McChesney. His most recent book is Blowing the Roof Off the 21st Century. And you were talking about mainstream media, or corporate media is usually the way that we're referring to it, but they do dominate and sort of create and guide the so-called mainstream narratives. Of course, they frame history off for their own interests, and the way they cover these events, like you said, when people get into the streets and raise hell, little attention is paid to the injustices that are decried, and much more attention is paid to the fact that this is an inconvenience for the middle, upper middle class. Peter and I, of course, have said for a while that we think that the corporate media is entirely irrelevant other than being a megaphone for the 1% or a medium for the plutocracy. In the media reform movement, I mean, of course, very important endeavors there, particularly with net neutrality, trying to really make sure that some of the communications technologies we have in the 21st century are used to help us achieve a more democratic society. But what do you see, as, and again, your connections with Free Press, freepress.net, duly noted. But you talk a little bit more about a radical media reform. And one, let's argue that some of the reforms that have been looked at, sort of trying to attenuate the FCC, trying to control some of what happens there. Those haven't been going so well with people like Tom Wheeler at the controls under Obama. So what do you see both, A, as the limits of this reform, and B, what we should be doing in its stead?
Well, I think the media reform movement, of which I'm part with Free Press and primarily in the last 10 years, when it was created, the idea was that we would have one foot in Washington and one foot in the country, and we do primarily field work to organize people around radical demands to make upon the media policymakers. And then we would go to Washington and raise hell and expand the range of debate and show that there was popular support for far more dramatic and radical shifts in media policy to open up space for nonprofit and non-commercial voices in particular, and also protect net neutrality and a host of other issues. And I think what happened to Free Press is we were far more successful inside the Beltway in the second term of the W. Bush administration than we ever imagined possible, to the point where a lot of what we're working on was embraced rhetorically by Democrats out of power. And I still would defend this as not an irrational move. We put all our chips on that number. And when Obama was elected and had commanding majorities in the House and Senate and would control the FCC, that we would be in a position to get a fairly progressive agenda through the FCC and through Congress. And that didn't happen. We won some stuff, and if we do win net neutrality, which we may well, to some extent it will be because of the commitments we got of President Obama when he was candidate Obama to support net neutrality. But in general, the FCC under Julius Genachowski basically did nothing and didn't want to rock the boat or antagonize the corporate interests. My argument is that things are so corrupt in Washington now. We still fight there. We still fight on net neutrality. But we really need to just get back to the countryside. We need to talk to people about meaningful issues that they can relate to that really go to the great crises we face. And I point out a couple in the book in the conclusion of what we should be working on. First of all, I think we've got to get rid of the ISP cartel. If you get broadband access or you have a cell phone, you're probably getting it from one of six or seven companies, and three companies in particular, Comcast, Verizon, and AT&T, dominate this cartel. And what I mean by cartel rather than an oligopoly is they pretty much don't compete at all on prices. They divided up the market and they split it between them. And these huge companies basically are government created monopolies, all of them. They wouldn't know competitive or free market if it kicked them in the butt. And they make huge amounts of profits. They're all spectacularly profitable. But because they own the politicians and the regulators, Americans today pay far more for cell phones, they pay far more for broadband service than they do in comparable countries for crappier service. Service is so much better when you go to Korea or Japan or Western Europe. And the cost is so much lower in most of these countries for broadband and for cell phones. And it's all because these companies have no incentive to give us high-quality, high-speed service because they can make more money giving us the garbage they are, and they own the politicians, so they don't have to worry about regulators, and there's no competition. So we should just get rid of these guys. They're parasites. The discussion should be about eliminating that crowd altogether and having a municipally run ISP and cell phone system across the country, like the post office. And that's where the debate should be. That's the rational way we should do something like this. And that's a radical demand. That seems incredibly radical in American politics. But in fact, that's actually not an anti-business demand. Most businesses would prosper to get rid of those parasites or just gouging them as well. That's a lot of what the net neutrality fight is about and why we have business support in the net neutrality fight. So that's one of the demands. Let's get rid of the ISP cartel and let's make it free and ubiquitous and have it run like the post office. Secondly, you know, the internet economy, you know, the internet has produced more monopolies than anything else in the history of capitalism, maybe the world. The companies that dominate it, there's just maybe a dozen or so. All the money is flowing to them. You're familiar with most of their names: Google, Apple, Amazon, Facebook, Microsoft, eBay, AT&T, Verizon, Comcast. These companies are spectacularly profitable. They're almost all monopolies in the economic sense of the term. And they almost all have unrivaled political influence over the government. Again, going back to our discussion of Milton Friedman and Franklin Roosevelt, this is not something we should be satisfied with, having this much monopoly power in such few hands. We should be talking about breaking these monopolies up, or, since I don't think they're break-upable in many cases, turning them into, you know, nonprofit, non-commercial, municipally run or government-run institutions. This is the debate we ought to be having. We ought to be debating, you know, whether their legitimacy rather than assuming it. And then finally, the most important issue to me gets back to what we've already talked about. journalism, as you know, is disappearing in the United States. Even our great journalists are having trouble supporting themselves. The commercial model of journalism is virtually disappearing. We probably have maybe 35 or 40% as many paid reporters and editors today on a per capita basis than we had 25 years ago. Most cities I go to, there's barely any journalists compared to what there was 20, 25 years ago. And this is because the financial basis of journalism, commercial journalism for the last century, has been advertising, which has provided between 50 and 100% of all the revenues. And in the new era of the internet, advertising no longer has to support content production in order to reach their target audience. We know from surveillance, these companies, their ad networks know everywhere you are online. They don't have to go to a newspaper website to try to find you there. They'll find you wherever you are and get their ad to you. And so there's not money to pay for journalism online or anywhere else. We've got to come up as a society with a way to fund nonprofit, non-commercial, independent media so people can make a living doing it. So we have people who are an obligation to cover politics and to cover the intersection of commercial interests and politicians. That's disappearing right now. And that is not a tenable situation for much longer.
Robert, we're originating, of course, from KPFA in Berkeley, California, which is a community radio station, listener-supported, and that's a vital, you know, public information source. You write about community radio stations and their importance. You were on one for a decade with your own show. And what kind of strategy should we be pushing for broader support of local community radio in the country?
Community radio stations have also gotten public money from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, pretty much oftentimes at about the same rate as NPR stations. That's sort of an unknown fact. And so they have not purely been supported by their listeners, but they depend primarily on their listeners. So the community radio is really a wonderful institution. I mean, an ideal media system is one where you have a heterogeneous system, where there's no one central source of control. You know, that's why the corporate system is so horrible, because it was a corporate monopoly, basically, with very little alternatives. And the corporate monopoly was largely homogenous when it came to journalism. You might as well have had Izvestia or TASS for all the diversity you got in terms of coverage of stories and range of stories. So we need to have policies that will support non-commercial, non-profit media, keep them independent, and also have competition. I think I know in a healthy world, the Bay Area would have 3, 4, 5 nonprofit, non-commercial news media competing with each other to cover stories, not just one. And I think that's really sort of the policy goal that I work for in the book and that I talk about in my work. And I think it's internationally becoming something that's getting a lot of attention as information disintegrates, as communication and journalism systems disintegrate worldwide.
Robert McChesney, toward the end of your book, Blowing the Roof Off the 21st Century, you, again, talking about Milton Friedman and certainly rightfully critical of many of Friedman's economic ideas when applied to things like education. But then you argue that these voucher-type programs, when applied to things like journalism, actually might work really well, given that the commercialism in terms of journalism has failed. Commercial support, advertising support, these are failed models, certainly failed when looking at it from the public interest perspective. And you write about economist Dean Baker talking about the idea of letting Americans direct money annually to nonprofit mediums. Project Censored's a nonprofit. We're into media literacy. We're working on 20 different campuses through education. We're on 20 different radio stations. But there are many models here, I mean, of a lot of great people and organizations doing great work that a lot of people just don't know about. And I think this voucher idea that you mentioned here with Dean Baker, and then, of course, you and John Nichols, of course, embellished on it. But this looks like something that you're considering at the end of your book as the viable solution, a direction to go.
I think it's clear now we need public support if we're going to have people who can make a living doing journalism, sufficient number, sufficient range. And that's how it was in the beginning of the American Republic. For the first century, most of our newspapers were delivered virtually for free by the post office. And it was a conscious policy by the government to lower the cost of printing because they wanted more newspapers. They said, we'll basically do the distribution almost for free for newspapers in America so it's easier for people to publish newspapers. We need the same sort of thinking today now that the commercial model is dying rapidly. And so the principle here is, well, you want government funding. You don't want the government to control who gets the money. And I think pretty much everyone agrees on that. That's not a very happy recipe to have government deciding who gets the money. So the principle of the voucher system, which comes out of a Milton Friedman plan for education, and it really follows his plan to a T, except it uses it for journalism, is that every American over the age of 18 would be entitled to allocate $200 of government money to any nonprofit news medium of their choice, as long as it meets a handful of criteria, most of which are already in existence, so it wouldn't even require much work, and they're not very controversial. And the only condition would be that the $200 they give to whichever medium qualifies. Whatever's produced with that money would have to be put instantly in the public domain for free, so anyone else could use it and have access to it digitally. And the reason you put that in is you're not trying to create a subsidy of corporate welfare for people to put up barbed wire around something. You want to basically pay people in advance to produce content, then make the content available to everyone. The genius of the system, of course, is that you give it to who you want. It's your choice. And if you don't want to give the money, you don't have to. If everyone does it, it's a $30 billion, $35 billion subsidy. And you can have vibrant media all over the country. And it also has a competitive aspect. You give your money to a group. Let's say someone gives it to Project Censor. Says, I want to give my $200 to you guys. And then after a year, they look at what you're doing and say, I don't think you guys really did what I wanted. They can give it to someone else the following year or break it up into bits. So it's a pretty flexible system as well. But it gets funds there to do media. It makes it competitive. And it keeps it nonprofit and non-commercial. So I think it's all good things for democracy. And if there are better solutions, I'm open-minded. I'm willing to hear them. That's the best one I've seen yet.
Well, Robert McChesney, you end the book with the quote saying, this is a quote from France in May of 1968, be realistic, demand the impossible. And it sounds, again, like through the course of this book, you know, you're talking about how, again, like when we started this discussion about civil rights, people didn't necessarily see this happening until it came. It just, there's these tipping points. And I think that's a great quote to end your book on, be realistic, demand the impossible. And we should be doing more of that such that the impossible not only becomes possible, but becomes inevitable.
Absolutely. I should have put that in, too.
Robert McChesney, thanks so much for joining us today for the Project Censored Show. Your newest book, Blowing the Roof Off the 21st Century, is a great overview of your scholarship, a great overview of your thinking on various topics, media, politics, and the struggle for post-capitalist democracy. Thanks again for joining us on the Project Censored Show.
My great pleasure.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians. Cause they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital.
That's our program for today. Thanks for joining us. The Project Censored Show airs on 20 stations around the U.S. For more information and to listen to archives of previous shows, go to www.projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook. Anthony Fest is our producer, Erica Bridgman, our engineer. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We'll see you next time.
It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain. But my people getting tired of the pain and the shame. We're not commodities or cogs that turn the global economy. We're the promise of a legacy, a spirit we're honoring. An anomaly to those who can't imagine a world without oppressive forces slaving for almighty dollar bills. We won. We got the love of it, our brothers and our sisters. About criminal minds, political ties, habitualized alibis, skies, another guise, democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burn bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, fall for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by taxes while the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens, and the times for the master thief. Combine, conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out the reach, all potential fame at the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that love of the brothers and our sisters.